the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, you're going to meet an attorney from Indiana, Zena Crenshaw Logal. She is a partner in a group called the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, and she's just published a 46-page report defining U.S. human rights enforcement as a shell game. And she talks about how whistleblowers and others who expose wrongdoing get the third degree. It's been going on for a long time, and we're going to see if we can expose this shell game and start the process of putting an end to it. And I always like to begin by thanking people who support my podcast with your subscriptions. And today I'm just going to mention one person, Joe Carson from Tennessee. He's a longtime supporter, an annual and monthly subscriber to the podcast, and he's a whistleblower whose efforts are covered in this new report. I'd like you to join Joe and become a subscriber. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then on Become a Subscriber. And you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. We've got the iPhone iPad app that's available at the Apple App Store. If you're an Android user, go to Spreaker.com. That's where you can access our podcast. There are many ways to do it. And however you choose to support me, I appreciate it. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we're going to talk about how whistleblowers get the third degree from our government. And we open with some slick disco music from the 70s. It's the Three Degrees. All right, I tried. Joining me today is an attorney from Indiana, Zena Crenshaw Logal. And there are a number of acronyms and group names here that we're going to lay on you. I'll try to do it in a way that helps you understand what we're talking about. But she has just released a report on what is called Opt-in USA, and we'll explain that in a minute. And the report is produced by the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, which was started by Zena and her husband. And there is also a colleague whose name is Andrew Jackson involved in this project. Zena, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
First of all, explain the meaning of the name of your organization, National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, and what motivated you to create this group.
Well, it's a takeoff from what was the title of the federal rules with regard to discipline of federal judges, the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Act.
Okay.
And I believe it's changed since then. So what we wanted to do was create an organization that focused on judicial conduct and disability, meaning disability to perform a judge's job. And this is a project, you know. So everything that has to do with judicial conduct and the ability of judges to perform their job began as our initial focus. But since then, we've branched off, and we are now a corporate umbrella for a variety of grassroots legal reform organizations that include but are not limited to focusing on the judiciary. So we might look at prosecutor conduct, issues involving the private bar of attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that has to do with the functioning of the U.S. legal system and its effectiveness or ineffectiveness in protecting individual rights.
And in particular, the rights of whistleblowers have been widely abused. And for this conversation, that's where I want to focus. But your work goes beyond the issues related to the legal rights of whistleblowers. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, we've had the term citizen whistleblower because when you're attempting to talk about the improper, you know, official misconduct, the misconduct on the part of public officials, then in a sense we're all whistleblowers. Whether it's actual misconduct, old-fashioned corruption, or just public policy considerations. So unfortunately, when you are critical of the people who enforce the law, historically you tend to become a target for retaliation. So in a sense, it's all about whistleblower protection.
Mm-hmm. And I'm reading here from your news release that you have initiated an international human rights claim for Americans enduring a persistent pattern of persecution and mental torture imposed through U.S. legal system abuse. And you use a term that every person can understand. You describe it as the third degree. Now, I think everybody knows, you know, in broad terms from movies and novels, what the third degree is. But how do you characterize it in this setting of the American legal system and people who are abused by it?
Well, what happens is when someone is a target of the third degree, then they only seem to be part of an adjudicatory process. In other words, you are part of an administrative or court procedure, but that procedure is not intended to reach a fair resolution of your legal claims. It has another function. And what we have done with the third degree is we have identified five distinct goals that are being pursued when someone is a target of the third degree.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is it involves an abuse of legal process, and there are seven distinct strategies, modalities, seven distinct ways that the legal system is abused when someone is the target of the third degree. So we've been able to identify these objective criteria so that you can distinguish the third degree from someone who is just simply dissatisfied or dislikes or has good grounds to question
mm-hmm.
what
and,
happens to them in court.
And let me, just reading from your report here, the five specific goals, you say targets of the third degree are invariably disparaged and discredited through legal process, intimidated for their activism through violence or threats, denied the equal protection of law and corresponding access to courts, impoverished through job loss, blacklistings, and you don't quite mention this, but the cost of legal action. And the fifth item is that they may be incarcerated under questionable circumstances. And so these are tactics or factors that describe how people who stand up and, you know, we're told, you know, in this new era of the American police state, if you see something, say something, right?
Yes.
But when people who are honorable employees, say, of the federal government, and they stand up and say, this practice is illegal, this practice is extremely dangerous, and my superiors are ignoring it, well, they get hit with the third degree. And what you describe here is consistent with the patterns that I've seen across the dozens of whistleblowers who I've talked to from almost every department of the federal government. And as you point out, this is not limited to federal employees.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that it's the more persistent and effective advocates who become the targets, because some people, the initial abuse of the legal system, you may suffer a wrongful conviction, and you become so incapacitated by that you're silenced. There's also people associated with family court abuses of process, and they may lose their children, and that so incapacitates them that they're essentially silenced. But those of us who continue to agitate and whistleblow and just basically make a nuisance of ourselves to people who want to abuse the legal system, then that's when you find the full-fledged targeting. So much so for some people that we literally could qualify for political asylum in other countries in some instances.
Now, you also note here, with limited exceptions, any legal claim that a target of the third degree pursues or defends against imposes on him or her a variety of the following detriments: procedural irregularities, one or more questionable departures from well-established precedent, undisclosed grounds for adverse credibility determinations, personal character disparagement, total or substantial denial of relief through judicial activism, judicial proscriptions that are the functional civil equivalent of ex post facto law, and total or substantial denial of relief pursuant to some form of judicial engineering. And in that last category, I would raise issues related to the way the federal government has used the state secret privilege to either throw out cases, gag witnesses and plaintiffs, and create pretexts to deny access to the courts for people who have extremely legitimate claims. And in this case, I'm thinking of my friend Sybil Edmonds, who blew the whistle at the FBI on really outrageous behavior that she observed. She was approached by a fellow translator in the FBI's translation division and invited to become a double agent for the nation of Turkey. And when she reported that, she was the one who was retaliated against, not her colleague who had, you know, clearly violated the ethics of an FBI employee. And so the use and abuse of state secrets in the last 15 years is something that I have grave concerns about, Zena.
Yes. And that's why it's been such a natural partnership between the grassroots legal reform community and the more classic whistleblower community, people who are whistleblowers because of statutory designation, as opposed to a broader use of that term, whistleblower. Because what happens is the whistleblowers have been very effective over the last three or four decades in getting statutory protections. But what they find is that spending the next decades or so having that legislative protection gutted and rendered meaningless through these court proceedings. I remember specifically when Sybil was presenting her claims and having them thwarted by these claims of national state secret, and was not able to find any relief through court proceedings.
All the way to the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there are other cases as well. We know that Binyam Mohammed was one of those held at Guantanamo Bay. And in 2009, his case came before the federal courts here in San Francisco. And he was trying to sue based on publicly revealed information about who operated what are called the torture taxis or these private jets that were leased by the government for so-called renditions, kidnapping of subjects. And Binyam Mohammed was one of those people who had been renditioned. And the case was thrown out, and the judge was asking the Justice Department lawyers, hey, you know, there's a new president. Did you get briefing on this and orders from Washington? And they said yes. And so the continuity, if not expansion, of the use and abuse of these tactics by the Obama administration, building on the use and abuse of the Bush administration, is something that I find outrageous, and that most people either are oblivious to it, or if they know about it, they don't seem to care.
Well, you're really pointing out the shell game that happens. So you have the executive branch creating these loopholes and exceptions and misusing national security and state secrets privileges in order to eliminate people's rights, or you have the courts interpreting our rights and our protections out of existence, or you have prosecutors who won't proceed to go against anyone who's accused of retaliating against the whistleblowers. And you have also the legislators who, the whistleblowers have been fortunate to get a lot of substantive protection, but a lot of times they pursue it for decades or they're not able to get it at all. So you just go from one branch of government to another trying to find reasonable relief and having it denied. Or perhaps you have one branch giving you protection and the other branch rendering it meaningless.
And Zena, when we then zoom out from these particulars that you and I have just described, the United States often criticizes other nations for human rights violations. Yet we can clearly construe these violations of the rights of whistleblowers and others who bring these kinds of cases in American courts, and they can't appeal beyond the U.S. system. Our exceptionalism as Americans permits us to, refer other countries to international judicial bodies for what we consider to be violations of human rights, but we don't allow that same external examination of our own problematic criminal justice and court system.
Exactly. And the United States has consistently pledged to honor these international human rights, and their contention has been that the U.S. legal system is more than adequate, provides more than adequate protection, when that has clearly been established, it's not the case. We base that on what happened, recently in the Amer Mishal case, where we had a U.S. citizen who was literally tortured while in Africa, and he came back to the United States and tried to bring a federal claim against his torturers, and was determined by the District of Columbia, the D.C. Circuit Court, that since this happened out of the country and involved national security, he was not entitled to sue. So, there were specifically U.N. representatives who were outraged because the U.S. had only recently proclaimed that it would bound itself, it would be bound by, its human rights obligations no matter where the offense took place, and that our U.S. legal system would protect Americans. And here you have a circuit court, a major circuit court, determining exactly the opposite. And then we also make that argument through our report.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you characterize the hypocritical stance, and this goes beyond just the current administration, but the posture of the U.S. government has been consistently do as we say, but do not hold us to the standard that we hold you to?
Yes, well, that is part of what is so important about making this report. We wanted to create public awareness that Americans have been isolated from the international human rights community. Imagine having our country being a party to these treaties that no American can actually enforce. For example, as you probably realize, a UN Working Committee recently determined that Julian Assange was being wrongfully detained in London.
Mm-hmm.
No American could get that type of international intervention. Even China was recently found to have violated the Convention Against Torture. UN human rights experts and torture experts confirmed that torture and ill treatment of prisoners was determined to be widespread throughout China and Tibet. When you have China, the citizens of China being able to secure that type of international oversight, to think that Americans cannot, it's just mind-boggling. And particularly for those of us who have, after 10 or 20 or 30 years of trying to get meaningful relief from rogue U.S. officials who are abusing their power, to think that we cannot secure that international intervention, it becomes quite staggering and frightening.
Mm-hmm. And, Zena, we don't have any recourse either. For example, I'm one of those people who is deeply offended that Barack Obama and his first Attorney General, Eric Holder, patronized us with this comment that we're looking forward, not backward. Therefore, we'll have no investigations or prosecutions of those responsible for the obvious torture violations that the U.S. committed, at least in the past. I hope that we're not currently doing it and that the president has stopped that, but I can't be 100% sure of that. And the abject failure to investigate and prosecute the financial crimes of those who helped bring down the economy in 2008. And we have no option for any kind of citizen indictment or any other venue where we can pursue these crimes when our elected leaders are really embracing a policy that amounts to obstruction of justice.
Exactly, Peter. You're really hitting on the key issues. This is not about so much having foreign interests impact sovereign, policy, sovereign function. This is about U.S. officials abusing power. They're rogue. And what we're seeking is when our own government won't provide redress, won't provide meaningful relief, we should be able to take this matter out to experts who function on a nonpartisan basis. They do not have the power to compel any particular action on the part of U.S. government, but they can ask for formal response, ask for formal input on the part of responsible U.S. officials, and in that sense, bring a lot of meaningful insight, oversight, to what is happening to private Americans. And to think that we cannot do that on the grounds that supposedly our legal system is more than adequate, and when we've shown that is not the case. At least this report, I think, is the first to attempt to establish in clear terms that we cannot rely on our legal system to effectively deal with entrenched legal system abuse. There's a lot at stake.
Yeah. Zena, I'm going to link to your report. It'll be in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And I encourage listeners to open it up. It's 45 pages, and there's a lot of really valuable information in here. We certainly can't cover it all in this podcast conversation. But I wanted to zero in on this one section where you talk about different types of retaliation and malice against whistleblowers. And one of the tactics that you describe here is isolate them and set them up for failure. And what it brings to mind is my friend Peter Van Buren. He worked at the State Department for more than 20 years, and under Secretary of State Clinton, he was sent for a one-year tour in Iraq, where he was assigned to spend our money on so-called reconstruction projects. And he was so offended by what he was tasked to do that he wrote a quite amusing book called We Meant Well. And in the book, there was no classified information whatsoever that was disclosed, but he described these boondoggles where he was authorized to spend millions of dollars of American taxpayer money on projects that he knew would not help the Iraqis and were white elephants from the day that they were, that construction started. Well, after We Meant Well became a bestseller, Peter Van Buren had his security clearance withdrawn, and they didn't fire him. He said they made him a walk-around employee. They took away his desk, but he was supposed to show up at Foggy Bottom every day and do nothing. And so he described how he'd go to the library for a couple of hours, and then he'd go to the cafeteria, and he would just wander the halls because he was on duty and being paid, but he was assigned no work, and they were essentially just putting him in what you describe here as bureaucratic Siberia. And, this is one of those tactics that is available to bureaucrats and to the political appointees who run these departments. But it's a gross abuse of the individual and a huge waste of our taxpayer money. And yet this goes on a daily basis. Russell Tice, one of the whistleblowers who was over at the NSA, told me how, as a highly paid employee and a guy with incredible technical experience and knowledge, they had him wash cars in the motor pool.
Exactly.
And so these are just a couple of examples that I know from my own contacts with whistleblowers. And these are infuriating tactics, but the bottom line is they generally work, don't they?
Exactly. You know, and our numbers are so high. What really got me on the path of eventually identifying the third degree is our numbers are so large. I could not imagine why it was so difficult for our ranks, people who have been subjected to this retaliation, to organize and mobilize and take advantage of democratic political processes, not to mention legal processes, and exposing what has happened, the unlawfulness of it, and sort of demanding relief the way you do lawfully in a democratic society. And so I was working with one of my board members, Dr. Shreya Mandel, and I asked her, I can't figure out quite why is it so difficult for us to harness this political power that we have through our collective, through our numbers. Now, Dr. Mandel is a mitigation expert. She's certified in global mental health and trauma recovery by Harvard Medical School. And it's very important to understand that this report that you're talking about, this Opt-in USA report, started with an article of hers, a 2014 article. And what she basically explained is that when you're denied due process and equal protection by an agent of government in the U.S., if that happens often enough, it can actually rise to the level of persecution and torture within the meaning of the Convention Against Torture. So they discredit you. You are isolated. A lot of people ostracize themselves or isolate themselves from society. And so you're rendered less effective. Your ability to work with groups and really come in and take, political action, it seems like that should be natural. But they basically rob us of our ability to harness that type of political power. Insofar as public awareness of what is happening to us, when you lose your job or when they get you to the point that you're not taken seriously, you're not a meaningful part of your, your job, then it's difficult for people to believe you when you say that this type of systemic abuse of government power is happening. People, I've gone to law school who have a lot of respect for me, and generally are prepared to give me the benefit of the doubt. They think that, well, maybe you didn't do something right. There's got to be some reasonable explanation because this type of, widespread oppression is not something that they're prepared to believe. And the people who are targeting us are very accomplished. They're very well regarded. I use the example among legal reformers. You may recall when retired U.S. Supreme Justice Sandra Day O'Connor would travel around the country, and she basically said all this well with regard to our legal system, and those of us who are discontent are perhaps just misunderstanding, or perhaps somehow we're just not qualified to make these critiques and these assessments. So hopefully your viewers, if they take a close look at the report, they'll see just how much of experts we have brought together to people who are unequivocal experts in their field and have identified these problems and these misuse of the legal system in a very objective, verifiable manner.
We're talking with Zena Crenshaw-Logal here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. And Zena, the reason I know about your report is that it includes coverage of the case of Joe Carson. And Joe is a man I've been talking to for more than 10 years. And in full disclosure, he is a staunch supporter of my podcast and a longtime subscriber. So I have a financial relationship with him on a very small scale. But, I like to disclose that so people understand the connections. And in your report, You take up the issues that he has raised, and I want listeners to bear with us here, because if you've never heard of the Merit Systems Protection Board and the Office of Special Counsel inside the Justice Department, pay attention here, because it gets, I understand, a little bit complicated. But, Zena, in simple terms, the MSPB, the Merit Systems Protection Board, is a place where an employee who feels they have been harassed or terminated unfairly can appeal their situation. And the Office of Special Counsel has a monitoring role over the Merit Systems Protection Board. Is what I've said accurate there?
It is.
Okay.
And then another thing that Joe emphasizes is that actually the Office of Special Counsel has sweeping powers with regard to ability to effectuate whistleblower disclosures. That it's his contention that under the statutes and relevant regulations, that the Office of Special Counsel can actually, when they receive a credible disclosure by any whistleblower, that they can take that disclosure and ask for a response on the part of the federal head of a federal agency that's involved. So, for example, in Flint, Michigan, when you have the problems with the water, mm-hmm. it's Joe's contention that any whistleblower could have brought to the Office of Special Counsel's attention this problem that was leading to the poisoning of the water in Flint, Michigan, and it would have been the special counsel's obligation to contact the head of the EPA and get a statement of position. It's basically the same type of function that the UN working committees could is entitled to fulfill on an international basis. This would be our domestic equivalent of the UN working committees. They would go to the appropriate U.S. leader and say, you know, we've had this problem identified. What is your position on it?
Mm-hmm.
And what Joe is pointing out is that the Office of Special Counsel shirks this responsibility, contends that he or she does not, whoever's the special counsel, that they are not obliged to take that role. And the MSPB, the Merit System Protection Board, which is essentially the judges,
mm-hmm.
They have said, yes, you do have this responsibility. But basically, you know, it's like a tag team between the Office of Special Counsel and the Merit System Protection Board. They don't give fair and impartial considerations of Joe's claims, and they keep finding technical ways to get around the substance of what he's saying and rule against him on technical grounds. So you never get a clear answer to his claims that the Office of Special Counsel has the authority to better protect federal employees and also to better effectuate whistleblower disclosures.
And Joe's complaint is not that his cubicle doesn't have the right feng shui or that they won't give him the right computer to do his job. These are really substantial allegations that he has raised about safety. And he's a nuclear engineer at the Oak Ridge facility there in Tennessee. And I honestly don't know all of the particulars of the issues that he has raised, but I'm satisfied, knowing Joe, that these are not trivial matters. And so this has gone on for years. And Joe, I think, makes a credible case about what he calls the broken covenant, that these laws are clear and they are there for federal employees to find appropriate protections when they want to disclose wrongdoing or health and safety violations. And yet he just gets the classic catch-22 runaround time and time again.
Exactly, and that's why he is one of the people featured in our report, because a prerequisite to seeking international oversight is you have to allege that there is an adequate domestic remedy, that you've basically exhausted all of your domestic avenues of recourse and found them unavailing or futile. And Joe has been at this for nearly three decades.
Yeah.
And so he is prepared to attest that no matter how these claims are presented, you're not given a fair and impartial resolution.
Mm-hmm.
You're not given serious consideration.
So next, tell us why you refer to many of us as Sisyphinians.
Because I thought about the character from Greek mythology, Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm.
And now he wasn't a particularly good person. He was supposedly an evil king, but his punishment was to roll a boulder up a hill every day for eternity. And he would roll the boulder up the hill, and then once he got it far up the hill, the sheer weight of the boulder would roll back down.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a certain futility in him rolling this hill up, this boulder up this hill every day, because it's going to invariably roll back down. And it's the same type of futility associated with us pursuing these various claims. You know, you pursue these claims, you do what you're supposed to do. You know, I monitor this closely. I see people doing it with various levels of expertise and sophistication. You know, some people, you know, perhaps they're not making the best arguments, or they're not, you know, could be better articulated. But I see people who at this point, is no way our legislators, our executive branch leaders cannot realize that these problems don't exist. And yet and still, none of us are getting any serious consideration. We either are met with silence, or we're met, like Joe, with a lot of technical rulings that never get to the substance of our claims. And it's just simply, at this point, is rendered the right to petition government in this country meaningless.
And Zena, you know, I've been monitoring these issues since Nixon was president. Okay, I have the benefit of that long-term look at these matters, and you know, from my perspective, we have the amazing ability to look at the faults that we have in our criminal justice system, and we're finally seeing rational analysis after three decades of, you know, increased incarceration and longer terms, minimum mandatories, all of these things that have created the huge prison population in our country. We're finally recognizing the flaws in the system, the bad laws. I mean, even Bill and Hillary Clinton have expressed their regret for the crime laws that they championed in the 1990s. Yet the issues that you raised are completely compartmentalized away from the conversation that even includes the Koch brothers and some extreme right-wing operatives in this country. But nobody is focusing on this sector of our law and the abuses that stem from the way people get the third degree, and our system fails to address that. Instead, it gives people the runaround.
Well, that's because for so many years there was so much subjectivity, you know, in evaluating what was going on. You know, there are a wide range of decisions that a judge can legitimately make in the case that you may not necessarily like, and so there's a question of perhaps it's just, you know, my opinion versus your opinion. Perhaps we're just misunderstanding. And keep in mind that we're just credited in the process. For example, there are a lot of encumbrances on my I'm not a lawyer in good standing. You know, I'm still admitted to the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, but my ability to practice in lower trial courts have on the state and federal level have been suspended. So, you know, so here I am being a leading critic of the judicial system, someone who, you know, is in such a compromised state of basically deemed unfit to practice law. So you have that, and then you have people who, the emotional toll, they become, you know, more emotional. A lot of times their language becomes very inflammatory. And so you also have major media who's not giving balanced coverage of the problem. You know, the only time you hear about the critics are when we're in trouble, when we get suspended, when we get arrested. And so what happens is the establishment has been able to hide behind, you know, the secrecy, the subjectivity. But what they didn't seem to realize is that, you know, given the internet and their persistence in this, you know, legal system abuse, after a while, certain patterns emerge. And that's what happened. You know, I could not believe that the legal system would persist in this way to the point that, you know, the frankly, criminality of the conduct was so be so clearly implicated, and that you were be able to identify distinct patterns in this perpetuation of the third degree. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have been able to do. And so at that point, you don't simply have to take my word for it or anyone's word for it. You can come in and see if these patterns exist. And in the situation of anyone who's claiming to be a target of the third degree, and what will happen is you will find, you know, these particular strategies for abusing the legal system, and if you don't see them, then it's not a situation of the third degree, even though you may have a questionable judicial outcome. It may be bad public policy, it may be harsh, but it won't be a targeting.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zena, this is not just an academic exercise on your part. In the last few pages of your report, you detail the price that you and your husband, Rodney Logal, are paying for some of your own activism. Give us a thumbnail of this court case that you're embroiled in and where your husband was recently sentenced to a fine and up to 30 days in jail, I think.
Exactly. One of the points we're trying to make is that the people who are critical of the system, you may have the sense that they're not... you know, they're not credible. They're not well regarded. Their opinion of you know whether the system is being used properly shouldn't be considered among people who are highly well regarded. But what you will find is a lot of time and effort spent on continuing to persecute us. Every leader that I know of the grassroots legal reform community have been impoverished. Many of them have actually went to prison. And so what has happened recently with my husband and I is we're constantly threatened with contempt, you know, and my husband was, in fact, sentenced for 30 days in jail based on a totally ridiculous contempt allegation.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give another example. There was a big effort to change to bring about the way they discipline lawyers judges in South Dakota, and there was a pretty wealthy businessman financing it. And of course, there was a ballot initiative that failed. But 2 years after that, he ended up going to jail on very questionable grounds. So. You know, what happens is you become a target, and somehow, if you're not actually, some people even meet with physical harm. But a lot of times, you find yourself going to being incarcerated under very questionable circumstances, whether some type of specious criminal charge or through contempt proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, Zena, do you have any knowledge of the case of Roger Shuler? He's a journalist from Alabama.
Exactly.
You know about him?
Yes.
Oh, well,
and he's still incarcerated, I believe.
No. He was, I know his case very well, and it's really sad and tragic because Roger Shuler spent many years as a blogger exposing the corruption in the courts in Alabama, initially focused around the case of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman, who remains in federal prison. He just celebrated his 70th birthday at the correctional facility in Oakdale, Louisiana, this week. And Shuler exposed that. He was fired from his job at the University of Alabama under phony pretenses. He continued to blog. And then because his coverage had touched on the sexual affairs of elected leaders and other prominent people in Alabama. They lowered the boom on him. And in a series of incredible extrajudicial processes, they brought out a retired judge who convicted him of a libel-type claim without his participation. I mean, it was all done in absentia. Then they issued a contempt order, and then they sent a cop to deliver some court papers. The cop beat Shuler up in his own garage, and then Shuler spent 5 months behind the bogus contempt charge in the local jail there in Shelby County until he finally relented and took down the blog post that the judge had found problematic. He left the state of Alabama after his house was foreclosed on, and he's had a series of additional problems where he's now living in Missouri. And his case cries out for justice, and he has exposed so much corruption in the courts in Alabama that I think we need a UN special commission to take over the courts in Alabama and try to air out these problems and correct them. They are so egregious.
Well, Peter, you are able to describe these type of circumstances in a way that's effective. You have all the years of building up an audience of people who know you to be credible and honest in your description of these circumstances. I do it by writing so that I can bring, you know, I don't have to, you know, provide conclusions. You know, I try to set out the facts so that people can reach the conclusion themselves that certain things are improper and illegal. And that's the benefit of doing it in these multiple venues. If I could, I just want to try to bring out, you know, what the circumstances are that causes this ineffectiveness of the legal system. It's really like a synergy. You have this, what do we call a culture of quiescence among U.S. lawyers and judges. Mm-hmm. You basically have lawyers who are so afraid of the prospect of being disciplined, wrongfully disciplined, that they're unwilling to take on these difficult cases. Then you have these ineffective federal agencies, such as, you know, the EEOC. You know, they're not protecting federal employees who are claiming to experience discrimination. Then you have the Office of Special Counsel that's being ineffective. So you've got these large bodies of federal employees, and they're supposed to go to the EEOC and the Office of Special Counsel to have their rights investigated, and then there's a process for you know, going through an administrative, like a quasi-judicial proceedings. That's ineffective. Then in the private sector, you got a beleaguered public defender system. And then you have us being, you know, persecuted through the third degree. And then you have the U.S., the Supreme Court. I don't think a lot of people realize that just this millennium, the Supreme Court has really insulated U.S. government officials, whether it's state or federal, from accountability. You know, they have so many immunities. Their discretion is practically unassailable. Mm-hmm. And then you top all of that off with our inability to reach out for international intervention. You know, it's a bit much to try to digest in the course of a radio broadcast, but it all works to put us in a position where we're vulnerable. We're not able to adequately protect our rights, even when we become the targets of fairly blatant, abusive, oppressive conduct that we normally associate with governments such as, you know, brutal dictators and totalitarian governments such as China.
Well, I was going to mention that what you just described, if we positioned it in Latin America, we'd call it a banana republic.
Exactly.
Well, Zena, I want to recommend your report to my listeners. I think you've done an excellent job of airing out these issues and defining the problems that we have. Where do we go from here? What do you want to see in order to really analyze the problems in our courts and move to correct them?
Well, you know, that's what a part of what we're doing. First, we want to, you know, get the problem identified, which we've done. We've sent the material out to various key leaders associated with the UN, including the U.S. ambassador to the UN. I'm now networking with the key human rights advocates who focus on U.S. governance, and I'm making some inroads. I'm supposed to do a presentation to the members of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and we just simply have to create a clamor for a change. Number one, the ability of our country to stay isolated and not allow Americans to enforce our own country's human rights obligations, our pledges on the international basis. That definitely needs to change. And then we have to continue to press our legislators to engage, because judicial oversight is part of their function, and we have to continue to press them to initiate legislative investigations to see the extent to which that this third degree is happening and the extent to which there are abuses of the legal system. It's difficult because, you know, when you're suffering, when your family, when you're losing your home, and you're being asked to do things that seem rather long term, it's difficult to get people engaged because basically they want a quick fix. They want their problem solved. But what we have to realize is that our entire legal system is not geared to provide this relief. So we've got to, for momentarily, shift our attention and work on, you know, getting change of our legal system. And in the course of it, you'll see a lot of self-correcting. You'll see a lot more judges sitting up and being unwilling to engage in some of this blatant misconduct. So basically, more of the same. And but we just simply have to be willing to do it, become more organized and mobilized to take advantage of our political power.
Zena Crenshaw-Logel from the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, thanks for joining us. You've done a great job exposing the shell game. Now let's see if we can put an end to it.
Thank you so much, Peter, for giving me this opportunity to share it with your listeners.
Well, we've exposed the shell game. Let's see if we can put an end to it. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.